Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Diagnostic Imaging, Petra Akhter. Thank you, Petra. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Sammy Jo, for the kind introduction. So we've got quite a lot of things to go through, and I would like to start without really any further ado. What we're going to talk about is an update on radiography and particularly the lungs. And I've pretty much started I was in general practice for a very long time, and I would like to start this presentation just with a few thoughts on thoracic radiology, and that is that it is difficult for everybody, not only for you vets in general practice, but also it is quite challenging even at a specialist level, and that is for different reasons. One of the reasons is that good thoracic radiographs are technically quite difficult to obtain. We also struggle with superposition of different structures. So when you think of an orthopedic radiograph, you generally just have, for example, the stifle. In the field of view, you've got less problem with superimposition, whereas thorax, of course, you've got the thoracic wall, you've got the heart, you've got all the different structures within the lungs. So superimposition is a big issue. We also have a wide range of normal variations. So loads there's a if you just think of dog with different thoracic cavity conformations, it can range, give quite a broad range of what can be normal. And then finally, quite often we have a similar appearance. So radiographic changes may be quite similar for a large variety of different diseases. And again, there can be an overlap with normal variation. So for all these causes, really, the thoracic radiography is quite difficult. Therefore, I would just it is quite important that we develop an approach to interpretation which is quite consistent and where we can try to kind of narrow down our differential list as much as possible, and that we arrive that we make really sound conclusions during our interpretation. So what I would like to share with you today is my personal approach to the lung interpretation in particular. There are different people, people do it in different ways, but I hope that this approach is going to be a kind of hands-on and quite accessible for everybody. So my approach is that whenever I'm presented with a radiograph and I want to find out really what is going on in a patient, I firstly try to assess whether the lungs are normal or abnormal. Now, that might sound quite easy, but first of all, of course, we need to establish what is normal, and that is with a broad range of normal variations, not always that easy. So, if we this is a presentation on radiography, but I've included some CT images just because I think it's quite helpful to understand what really is going on in the thorax on a radiograph. So when you have a look at this CT image here, I'm just getting a pointer out. So we've got the thoracic wall that we've discussed. This white thing here in the center is the diaphragm. We've got the esophagus here, and we've got the aorta. And these areas here are the lung lobes. We're in the caudal thorax, so this is the accessory lung lobe, and then here we'd have the left caudal lung lobe. And you can see we've got the bronchi here, so bronchial wall. We've got the lumen of the bronchus, which is very dark, so in a radiograph that will be obviously radiolucent. We then got the lung parenchyma, but if you look carefully, you can see that actually The opacity or the density of the lung parenchyma is not quite as dark as that of the lumen within the bronchus. So that means that the lungs have got, they do attenuate the X-rays a little bit. So always we will have a little bit of a more increased opacity if the X-rays go through lung parenchyma or if they just go through thin air. So, for example, that explains why in a pneumothorax you will have a lot less opaque lung, sorry, a less opaque thoracic cavity overall. But it also explains that, so here we've got the pulmonary vessels, so they're normal to see, and the larger bronchi we can see on a radiograph as well, as I'll go through with in a moment. So this is just to illustrate really what is going on in a normal lung. So radiographically, if we translate that into a radiograph, we've got the extrathoracic structures here, we've got the heart, we've got the pulmonary vessels, the trachea in this case, caudal vena cava, and then quite a lot of superimposed structures. And I know that sometimes it's actually challenging to find out really whether that is still normal or not. But this is an illustration of a normal dog without clinical signs relating to the thorax. The dog was presented for a MET check. So it's normal to see pulmonary vessels. It's normal to see some bronchi in near the hilus. We have got a little bit of a background opacity generally. This is less so in the cranioventral thorax, but caudodorsally, it's quite normal to have a bit of a general opacity. So this is quite, it's quite helpful to just have this as a kind of normal template in the back of your mind, or to have atlases which you can refer to. There are now also online, some online material where you can have a normal thorax next to your patient in the clinic on the monitor, for example. So this is an example just for abnormal lungs. So immediately you can see, if we go back to the normal, that this is abnormal. In some cases, obviously, this will be more subtle. I will come back to this patient a little bit later, but probably the most prominent feature in this example compared to the normal thorax, which I showed you, is that we've got some changes here, particularly in the periphery of the lungs. So, if we want to explore whether something is normal or abnormal in more detail, there are three major things to look at. So, if our general gist is yes, this patient seems like it's got abnormal lungs, what are the things we want to look at? We'd want to, first of all, see whether we think the opacity is increased or decreased. We want to also assess whether the lung volume is increased or decreased. And then finally, if we think that a structure is abnormal, or that we've got an increased or decreased abnormality, sorry, a decreased or increased opacity, we also just want to double check that we're really, really sure it's in the thorax and not, for example, representing an extra pulmonary lesion. So we're going to go through this step by step. So increased versus decreased opacity. So this is going back to the example that I showed you of an abnormal thorax. In this case, we can appreciate that there is an increased opacity in the peripheral regions of the lung fields. Whereas if we go to a patient like this, this is a patient which had a traumatic pneumothorax and a traumatic pulmonary bulla. So here the main finding would be a area of decreased opacity in the caudodorsal lung field, which represented a lung bulla. So on a very basic level, what we want to find out overall is there an increase in opacity or is there a decrease in opacity? Of course, There's also instances where there is radiographic technique which might go into this. So if we think, okay, we've got an overall decrease in opacity, it's just important to quickly double check, do we think this could be due to technique? This was relatively straightforward in the good old days when we had film radiography, so film screen radiographs. Now in the digital world, it's a little bit more difficult because it's not only the exposure of the radiograph which matters, but also the display on the screen and the processing algorithm. But just very briefly, the example here on the left would be an example where either the radiograph was tremendously overexposed, or we chose the incorrect algorithm, processing algorithm, or it might just be that it's a problem with the display on the digital screen. Whereas the example here on the right is an example of an underexposed radiograph, or again, an incorrectly displayed grayscale. So those are just important things to bear in mind. Then, similarly, you can get a increased sort of, not artificially, but it's a physiologically increased, overall increased opacity in the lung field if you've got an expiratory radiograph. So this is an example where we've got the same patient, so this is an anaesthetized cat, same position, so both right lateral radiographs, one in expiration accidentally. And then we noticed, oh, this is really expiratory. We've got what looks like a diffuse interstitial lung pattern, but actually, because the radiograph is so so expiratory, this is not reliable. So we asked our staff to repeat this, and then here we see this is actually quite a normal looking chorda dorsal lung field. There may be something going on craniventrally, but chorda dorsally, you can see what difference an inspiratory radiograph makes. So I'm not saying it's always possible to obtain really truly inspiratory radiographs. I know that we have to sometimes radiograph sedated patients, but before you jump into conclusions that something is pathological, it's important to just have a look. Do we think exposure is adequate, display is adequate, is a processing algorithm adequate, and do we think that the patient has been radiographed in inspiration or is as inspiratory as it is possible? And if it's not possible, then we just have to interpret everything with a kind of degree of caution. So what we're aiming for is a radiograph which is reasonably inspiratory, and we've got nice and balanced grayscale. So in this case, that would be a radiograph of diagnostic quality. As I said, it's not always possible to have a really perfect radiograph, but if it is not quite perfect, we just need to keep that in back of our mind and just make sure we take that into account when interpreting our findings. Another thing to bear in mind is in technique is to just check that we've got all the views that we need. And just very briefly take a few seconds to look at the radiograph here. And just ask yourself whether you can see any abnormalities. So what we can assess here is that we've got some overlap between the diaphragm and the heart, so it's not a and the diaphragm is generally probably a little bit far cranial, so it's not perfect in a perfectly inspiratory view. Therefore, we've got a bit of an increased overall increase in opacity chorda dorsally. You could argue it is perhaps a little bit more so in the perihilar area. There may be an increase of opacity here, but I don't think any one of us would comfortably say there is a definite lesion here. Now, take a look at these two views here. So the first one I showed you is a right lateral, then we've got a left lateral view here on the left, and we've got a DV. And this is quite a scary example, I think, illustrating that how important it is to take sufficient number of views because we can overlook mass lesions or other pathology. So also with aspiration pneumonia cases, I had it that actually one lateral looked absolutely fine, but there were quite marked changes on the other lateral and the DV view. So one view, if we're doing a MET check or if we want to get a really comprehensive idea of what's going on in the thorax, is not enough. Always, always, ideally aim for three views. So this was a case of a metastatic neoplasm, which we would have overlooked if we would have just taken one radiograph. The second question we need to answer is the lung volume increased or decreased? I showed you the example of inspiratory versus expiratory. So that obviously is a difference. Here we can say the lung volume is decreased, hence we need to be careful with interpretation of an interstitial lung pattern. But if there's one thing I would like you all to take home with, then it is that you should always, always take the DV projection first. And that is because we can get lung collapse really, really quickly. So this is again an example of a CAT, this time not the same patient. But in this patient, unfortunately, a left lateral radiograph was obtained before the DV. And we can see that there's an increase in opacity in the cranial lung field, perhaps also caudally, a little bit on the left side. Whereas in this example here, where this was an example where the DV was taken immediately, you can see we've got actually quite normal appearance of all lungs. Now, the difficulty with the case here on the left is that I could not guarantee that this is a normal CAT. This may be a normal CAT, which was just lying on its left side, but we could also have pathological causes of atelectasis. So that is why taking the DV first is really, really important. And just very briefly, illustrate this on a CT, what happens. When you are in a DV position, everything is fine. As soon as you put the patient in lateral recumbency, you can see that the lungs collapse. So this is a normal dog, normal lung parenchyma, but this is what happens when the patient lies on their side. And that's why we always should aim to take the DV first. This shows, and actually, quite frustratingly, it can take a long time to reinflate the lungs. So once you have this level of atelectasis, it takes a long time to reverse it. So therefore, always, 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 whatever you do, take the DV first, please, to avoid problems with interpretation. So now we're coming back to our interpretation. We want to assess whether we've got a decreased lung volume or whether it's a preserved lung volume. And I would like to illustrate this in this example. So this is our collapsed CAT that we had, the lung collapse that we had in the previous example. And this is an example of a dog with pneumonia, where you can see that in our case with lung collapse, we have what we call a mediastinal shift. So you can see the heart here, and the heart is displaced over to the left hemithorax. Whereas in our example here, we can still roughly appreciate the cardiac silhouette, although it is a bit effaced, so it's not fully seen because we've got so much pulmonary changes as well. And in this example here, we've got a right middle lung lobe, which is increased in opacity but preserved its normal volume. And similarly, we've got the left lung lobes, which perhaps have reduced their volume very slightly, but overall, the heart remains in a normal position. The significance of this is that if you've got lung consolidation, so if you've got a preserved lung volume but an abnormal opacity, this is always abnormal. Whereas if you've got a decreased lung volume with an increased opacity, that can represent just normal atelectasis due to recumbency. It could, of course, also represent pathology. So a case where perhaps we've got a pathological calls for a decrease in lung volume. Overall lung volume would be pulmonary fibrosis. That would be a prime example. So this is a patient where we've got an overall increase in opacity, but simultaneously a decrease in volume, because the diaphragm is in a slightly more cranial position than normal. And importantly, in these patients, you will see really no significant or at least very little difference between an inspiratory and an expiratory radiograph. And that is because the lung has lost its lung compliance. So that's why it's very important to put the two things together. And in cases of pulmonary fibrosis, it is quite helpful to try to take radiographs in inspiration and expiration, just to make sure that we're not mistaking one expiratory radiograph for pulmonary fibrosis. On the opposite scale, we would have feline asthma. So here, for example, or feline lower airway disease in general, where we can have air trapping. So in these cases, we sometimes have an overall increase in lung opacity. So this was a spontaneously breathing cat, not under general anesthetic and not without manual inflation. And you can see a very flat diaphragm. And in these cases, you will again have quite little difference between inspiration and expiration. So the hallmarks would be a relatively low or no increase in opacity, perhaps a decrease in opacity if you've got very severe cases of feline asthma, but also a relatively high volume lung. So finally, we would need to find out, do we have an extra pulmonary lesion, or is the increase in opacity that I'm seeing truly, or the decrease truly within the lung? And I've included just one example here. So classic examples would be skin lesions, for example. But this is another example. So what we can see is an overall increase in opacity in the quarter dorsal lung field. There's no particular increase or decrease in lung volume appreciable on this in this view, but what we can see is that lesion has got quite a broad base towards the periphery. And then when we look at the corresponding DV view, you can actually see an increased opacity here in the midline, and this was a case of a parasophageal mass, so not arising from the lungs in this case. And that is because you can actually follow it from the abdomen into the lung. So it's just important in some circumstances, particularly if got broad-based lesions, to also consider extra pulmonary origin. So this really concludes our section, do we think lungs are normal or abnormal? And now we come to the more specific distribution of affected lung lobes. And that is important because a combination of different findings can lead you to different differentials, which I'll come to shortly. And I've borrowed this illustration from the BSAVA manual of canine and feline thoracic imaging, which I can just generally thoroughly recommend. And it can help you to guide you to be a little bit clearer as to where an abnormality is located. I'll come back to the specific lung lobes a little bit later. But just to give you a general illustration, this is quite a nice publication to go to. Just to simplify this, we can also say quarter dorsal or craniovental lung field. So examples, for example, for craniovental changes would be aspiration pneumonia. So you can often see that cranioventurally. Quarter dorsal examples would be if we had non-cardiogenic edema, that would be quite a common example for quarter dorsal changes. Or bronchointerstitial changes often are also more severe quarter dorsally often. Then we've got perihilar lesions. So common example would be cardiogenic edema in dogs. And then peripheral lesions, a good example would be, for example, pneumonia. So now I would like to run through appearance of lesions or specific lung patterns. All these three things will, if you follow this will then basically generate a short list of differentials, which I'll mention as we go through the different lung patterns. But it is vital that you don't skip the initial steps, because I think it can just help you to avoid certain pitfalls, which will come through, which we'll come to in a moment as well. So now we'll go through appearance of specific lung lesions, or different lung patterns. And I'm quite a fan of lung patterns, although I think I appreciate people find them quite difficult sometimes, or they don't quite understand why we use them. I think they are quite helpful for me because I immediately have a differential list for different types and of presentations, and therefore I find it quite easy to pull out my differentials when I see a specific pattern. So, first of all, I would like to talk to you about lung masses because they're relatively simple, as it were. So, what happens is that you have an increase, a focal increase in opacity. You've got a single lesion mostly, which may be well defined, maybe a little bit ill defined. So, in this case, it's relatively well defined. As opposed to the lesion that we had in the caudal dorsal thorax earlier, we can actually see it all the way around. It hasn't got a broad base. It doesn't merge with the diaphragm. So this is the difference. Although I appreciate it is also very much in a midline position here on the dorsoventral view. So this was a case of a lung mass, which was quite extensive. It was involving the right accessory lung lobe, as well as the labeling is incorrect, by the way, here. Unfortunately, no, sorry, it is correct, but they're superimposed onto the thorax, which is not ideal, of course, in this case. So this was a case of a mass lesion in the accessory and the right caudal lung lobes. So they're generally not difficult to spot. Lung masses are one of the easier ones. My top differentialists. The differentials I've got on the slides are not exhaustive. They are my personal top differentials. But what is important, which I'll mention later, is that we always correlate that with the area that we live in. So in the United States, for example, the differential list will be very different for a nodular lung pattern than it is in the UK. It's also different whether a patient has travelled somewhere or not. And it's important to just cross-reference this with a patient presenting signs and with a patient signalment. But as a general rule of thumb, my top three differentials for a single lung mass would be a primary pulmonary neoplasm, such as a bronchogenic carcinoma, histiocytic sarcoma, or a lot less likely, but depending on patient age and whether or not it's a Springer Spaniel, for example, granuloma or an abscess, for example, due to a foreign body. And this already brings us to the lung patterns. So we've got general lung patterns. The most common ones I'll talk to you about two less common presentations at the very end as well. So the more typical or the classic ones are bronchial lung pattern, interstitial lung pattern, which we subdivide into a nodular interstitial and unstructured or linear interstitial lung pattern, alveolar, vascular, which we subdivide into hypovascular and hypervascular, and a mixed lung pattern. So we'll run through them together with the top differentials for those. So a bronchial lung pattern is perhaps the easiest of the lung patterns. So what we tend to see here are the classic tram lines, so parallel lines in the lung fields, or the donuts, so that's or signet ring signs. So we've got round donuts, which you can see in multiple areas, not just the parihilar area, but you can see that in a even far into the periphery. And on the right, again, I've included a CT image just to for your illustration, so you can see what this looks like on a CT and why it looks like it on a radiograph. So on a CT, you can see here, this is the really thickened bronchial wall in cross section, and in a long axis, cutting the bronchus in a long axis. So this is basically how the tram lines and the donuts come about. This example here on the left is a cat with feline lower airway disease. Pitfall to avoid is bronchial mineralization. A lot of dogs will have bronchial mineralization as a completely incidental finding, and that can happen quite early in life. The difference is here that you have, although you've got an increased visibility of the bronchi quite far to the periphery. Look at this tram line here. Look at this one here. This goes really far into the periphery. So a tram line really far distant from the hilus. But the difference is these tram lines are thin. These opacities are really, really thin. The donut here is really thin. So we've got very thin bronchial walls, although they are quite conspicuous. So going back to this one, this is very different. We've got thick walls, quite thick walls. They're similar almost to blood vessels. Not quite. So these would be my top differential list for common lung patterns. So if I just see a bronchial lung pattern without much else, so perhaps what I should say is that if we see changes and we recognize a certain lung pattern, even if it's mixed, we would always be led by the most obvious, by the most prevalent lung pattern. So if I see a bronchial lung pattern as a main finding, then I would immediately go to bronchitis or feline lower airway disease. So depending on the species, in dogs that would be chronic bronchitis, in cats feline lower airway disease, which could be bronchitis or asthma. Although of course in asthma we know that sometimes you may not actually see any radiographic changes, so absence of changes does not rule out feline asthma. In dogs also we've got eosinophilic bronchopneumopathy. That would be quite a common finding, and depending on where you live, Angiostrongylus vasorum infections. What's important to know is that bronchial lung pattern is very commonly seen just as a proportion of a part of a mixed lung pattern, very commonly in bronchopneumonia, also aspiration pneumonia, I suppose, and again, Angiostrongylus vasorum infections. In some types of bronchogenic carcinomas, you can have a very heavy bronchial component, and it can be as a mixture of a bronchointerstitial lung pattern and pulmonary fibrosis as well. Although there, the bronchial component is not as marked. So we generally, with pulmonary fibrosis, we'd perhaps expect the interstitial components to be at least as bad as the bronchial component. Although there has been a study showing that radiography is not very helpful to differentiate bronchial pulmonary fibrosis versus chronic bronchitis in small dogs. So, if we now come to the nodular interstitial lung pattern, this is also relatively easy. We differentiate generally between larger nodules and miliary nodules. I'll just illustrate that in a second. So, this was a case, a quite sad case, of a dog which had treatment for osteosarcoma by forelimb amputation, treated by forelimb amputation, and then, unfortunately, a few months later, which is not uncommon, of course, the dog developed pulmonary metastases. So, these are not difficult to spot. So, the hallmark sign would be In this case, a really quite classic cannonball metastases, very perfectly round, well-defined opacities scattered throughout the lung fields. This is an example of a miliary lung pattern. So this is generally a little bit more difficult to spot. As a general rule of thumb, nodules need to be at least 3 to 5 millimeters in size so that we can recognize them as an individual opacity. Miliary nodules are a lot smaller, so they tend to be 1 to 2 millimeters. So if we had just a single 1 to 2 millimeter nodule, we would generally not see that on a thoracic radiograph. We would see it on CT, but not on a radiograph. The reason why we can recognize the nodules in a miliary lung pattern is because there's thousands of them typically, so there's loads and loads of them. So if you look at this radiograph, for example, you can just make out that there's loads and loads of tiny little opacities. And because they're summate, they kind of are all superimposed onto each other. That's why we can see them. There's also a little bit of a bronchial component in this case. So this was a dog with pulmonary lymphoma. There are pitfalls to a nodular interstitial lung pattern. It is quite easy to recognise, so we look for nodules, but there are a few things to consider. We have, for example, osseous metaplasia. So if you see really tiny nodules, which would normally be a miliary lung pattern, but they're really, really obvious. So you've got 1 to 2, perhaps up to 3 millimetre nodules, really obvious. In a dog, a very, very common differential is osseous metaplasia, also called osteomata, pulmonary osteomata. They're commonly seen in older dogs, quite often collies, quite often ventral distribution. They are also quite often not quite typically round. They're often a little bit irregular in shape. It is extremely rare for pulmonary neoplasia, pulmonary metastases to mineralize. So if you see very small mineralized lesions in the lung in dogs, really osseous metaplasia is your absolute top differential, which is an absolute benign finding without any clinical significance. Another thing which can happen, of course, is that we can have end-on blood vessels. These we can generally recognize by looking at the size of them. So for example, if we look a little bit into the periphery in this case, if we look here, end-on blood vessels would be of soft tissue opacity rather than mineralized normally. Or they may be a little bit higher because they're end-on, of course, but you'd normally expect to see them more clearly in the perihilar region, and normally their size would correspond to an end-on blood vessel in the same area. Skin lesions, superimposed skin lesions are a pitfall for a nodular interstitial lung pattern. And then you also need to beware bronchial plugs, particularly in cats. So cats with feline asthma, they can, or bronchitis, they can produce a lot of mucus. The mucus can form a plug in the bronchus, and then that can look like a nodule as well. So to give you my top differentials, so if you've decided something is a true nodular lung pattern, or if you have multiple pulmonary masses, no, not just a single one, masses, normally the cutoff would be something like 3 centimetres. So anything below 3 centimetres would normally be called a nodule. Everything above 3 centimetres would be called a mass. So my top differentials would be pulmonary metastases, but also eosinophilic granulomatosis. So that's a benign condition in dogs, quite uncommon. So my top differential would always be pulmonary metastases in my clinic here. I would also consider eosinophilic granulomatosis, particularly if it is a younger dog. Infectious granulomatous disease, important to consider, particularly in cats. We had a few cats with pulmonary mycobacterial infections. Fungal disease, if you have a travelling dog. So in the US, as I mentioned, pulmonary nodules would have a different differential list, and that would mean that in endemic areas, actually, you could not say whether something was more likely to be a pulmonary metastatic disease or fungal disease. So just important to rank your differentials depending on where you are in the world. A miliary lung pattern, slightly different differentialist. So here we could be with neoplastic a little bit more, with neoplasia a little bit more specific. Typically it would be pulmonary lymphoma or carcinoma metastases, the more typical one, examples for neoplasia. In terms of what gives you a miliary lung pattern. And then granulomatous disease would also be a possibility. And in this case, it would be more typically the infectious types of granulomatous disease. So I wouldn't expect necessarily eosinophilic granulomatosis to give me a miliary lung pattern. So that would be my personal top differentials. The unstructured interstitial lung pattern is perhaps the most overdiagnosed of all lung patterns, because of the expiratory phase, which can mimic or which can kind of lead to an interstitial lung pattern without presence of pathology. But as we already previously mentioned, this is a case of pulmonary fibrosis where we have a pathological interstitial lung pattern, and the hallmark sign is an overall increase in opacity. So without a structure to it. You can also sometimes get a little bit of a linear component to the lung pattern, but basically no nodules. So just to give you an illustration of what happens in CT. So at the bottom here, we've got a CT example that I showed you right at the beginning of the presentation, a normal patient. Here, we've got a patient with an unstructured interstitial lung pattern. You can see that just the background density is very different. So this is exactly what happens radiographically. This patient here, more ventrally, has got a slightly more linear structured component, but essentially no nodules. So that's the difference in the interstitial lung pattern. We'll come back to this CT in a second when we talk about alveolar lung patterns as well. But first of all, just to very quickly browse through the pitfalls of the interstitial lung pattern, poorly inspiratory radiograph we mentioned, digital radiographs, we can make look anything like anything nowadays. So on our digital screen, if we just move the grayscale, we can of course increase the opacity of the entire image, but we just need to be careful that we want to really adjust our grayscale display to a pleasant balanced view. And then also, a commonly cited cause for an unstructured interstitial lung pattern is it can be a normal aging change, although there is a discrepancy of views in the radiologists were in the radiology world, really, whether that is true or not. So my top differentials for an unstructured interstitial lung pattern, once we've decided it is a true finding, is that the pulmonary fibrosis cases, lymphoma, again, it can give you a miliary lung pattern, but it can also give you an unstructured interstitial lung pattern. Non-cardiogenic edema would be a common one. Here, it would be particularly common in the chordodorsal lung fields. Focal or multifocal causes. So the first point was if we have a diffuse distribution, so across all lung fields, which is why I gave you the in the earlier in the presentation a quick overview over the distribution of the different lesions. So here we have the differentials for a diffuse lung pattern. Then if we have multifocal changes in different areas, or in just one area, one example would be a foreign body, particularly in the caudal lung lobes. That would be a very common finding, an unstructured interstitial lung pattern in just one area. And then if we have it as a part of a mixed lung pattern, it can help us to it can be a common mixed component to just generally airway disease. What I forgot to mention with a bronchial lung pattern is that if we see a bronchial lung pattern, it can be a very, very important aid to us, to alerting us that we've got an airway disease here. So that basically, if we see a bronchial lung pattern, it means there's pathology involving the airways, and that has consequences as to the further management, because we know a BAL is likely to be helpful. Whereas if we see just an interstitial lung pattern without a bronchial component, BAL is quite likely to be very unrewarding. So it can guide us really towards appropriate further tests as well. So very as a kind of last point in this section, I would like to go through the alveolar lung pattern, which is perhaps a little bit more easy to spot and categorize than the kind of diffuse interstitial lung pattern, because it tends to be more focal. So it's quite rare to really have a completely homogeneous alveolar lung pattern. The main difference between an alveolar lung pattern and an interstitial lung pattern is also that the alveolar lung pattern is more severe. So you start losing, whereas with an interstitial lung pattern, you can still see the background structures in the lung, the normal background structures in the lung. You lose that with an alveolar lung pattern. And I've got different examples here. So this is an example where we see air bronchograms, which is a hallmark. If you see air bronchograms, you can automatically say this is an alveolar lung pattern. This is so severe, it has to be an alveolar lung pattern. However, you don't need to have an air bronchogram for it to be an alveolar lung pattern, if that makes sense. So, for example, here, this is the case we've seen earlier on. This was a case of angiostrongylus vasorum infection. So here we've got a peripheral distribution of the alveolar lung pattern. So in areas we lose the background lung structure. And then this example here on the left, we've got what's called a lobar sign, which is also a hallmark of the alveolar lung pattern, where we can see very a clear demarcation between the abnormal and the normal lung, or more normal lung in this case, so we can see the lung borders. And just to give you another illustration in a CT, how this looks on CT, which probably illustrates it and brings it back home a bit. So if we have a look here, we've got normally we would expect to see the pulmonary vessels, but we lose those pulmonary vessels even on CT. All we can see is the air-filled lumen of the bronchus, and this is why this is exactly how a case like this would look radiographically. And just to illustrate the difference between what happens in an interstitial lung pattern and an alveolar lung pattern more clearly on CT, is here we had this just very diffuse background opacity increase, but you can very clearly still see the pulmonary vessels in this example, whereas on CT with an alveolar lung pattern, even with CT, you start losing the vessels. So that's basically the big difference. My top differential list for alveolar lung pattern, if it is affecting one specific lobe, my top differentials would be aspiration pneumonia and as we mentioned, this happens in the cranioventral lung field, particularly on the right side. We can also get lobar pneumonia due to other causes. This can happen, for example, due to aspiration of inhalation of a foreign body. Also, histiocytic sarcoma, as an example of neoplastic disease, can affect often just one lung lobe. And what you can sometimes get is rather than a mass, you can just get a consolidation of the right middle lung lobe with histiocytic sarcoma. So that's an important example for alveolar infiltration. If we have a perihilar distribution in case of an alveolar lung pattern, we commonly see that in case of cardiogenic edema. So that would be kind of like an example here. We would then also expect generally an enlarged cardiac silhouette. And peripheral distribution, that was the example I showed you earlier with bronchopneumonia and sometimes with angiostrongylus vasorum infections, we would expect a peripheral distribution. So that's That was the example here. Right. Actually, I think we I'm getting a little bit I think we started a little bit late, but I'm also cautious of time, so I forgot that I also need to tell you about the vascular lung pattern, of course. I said the alveolar was going to conclude, but it's not. We obviously, of course, have got the vascular lung pattern. It's relatively easy. So the we normally expect to see pulmonary vessels. So what we need to decide is, are the pulmonary vessels normal in size or are they not? As a general rule of thumb, we use the fourth rib, the proximal fourth rib, to compare with. So the pulmonary vessels should be roughly between 3/4 to maximal the full size of the proximal fourth rib, the cranial pulmonary vessels. On a DV radiograph, we would compare the pulmonary vessels with a ninth rib at the point of interception. And this is an example here on the top of smaller than normal blood vessels. So these probably not even reach half the width of the fourth rib. And then this example here at the bottom is a hypervascular lung pattern where the pulmonary vessels are bigger. So my top differentials for this, for a hypervascular lung pattern, so once we concluded the pulmonary vessels are bigger, normally I would expect other signs as well. I would either expect a bigger heart, a smaller heart, variety of different pulmonary changes perhaps. So if we also had, for example, perihilar increase in opacity, a common differential would be congestive heart failure. We can, of course, also just have hypervolemia, so due to IV fluid supplementation, for example. Left to right shunts can cause a hypervascular lung pattern. Then examples for hypovascular lung patterns would be hypovolemia and shock. That would be this example here at the bottom. Hypoadrenocorticism, severe pulmonary stenosis, and right to left shunts. Just these are the very last slides, so we're coming just to conclude, just to give you two other types of lung pattern which are not on the classic lung pattern list. This is an example for a vesicular lung pattern, and that is almost pathognomonic for a lung lobe torsion. So if you see something like this, so an overall increase in opacity, but within this increase, tiny little gas bubbles, that is called a vesicular lung pattern. Very, very important to bear in mind as a if you see this, this is a very high chance that this dog has a lung lobe torsion. And then finally, just a very few words on cavitated lesions. What we have is here we've got a decrease in opacity. I gave you this example at the beginning. Cavitated lesions are slightly different because they've got a different differential list and they don't fit really neatly in the lung pattern type of scenario. So if you've got just a plain loosened lesion with thin walls, then you would either typically deal with either a congenital pulmonary bulla or with a pneumatocele, which is the classic traumatic bulla, which is the example I gave you here. Those traumatic lesions can sometimes contain at least a proportion of fluid as well, and that's this example here in the CT examination. So you can see a little bit of fluid, the fluid meniscus, right at the bottom. And importantly, over time they can fill up more and more with fluid, and they can actually give you also the impression of a lung nodule. They're typically more over it in shape, and it's not that common to see them, so that's why I didn't include them in my top differential list for a nodular interstitial lung pattern. But in patients with previous trauma, this can sometimes happen. And then, so these would be typically lesions with very thin walls, the first two. You can also get cavitated nodules or masses, and they typically have a thicker wall, but and then perhaps an irregularly outlined lumen. And typical examples for that would be fast-growing neoplasms, and abscesses or granulomas. So, as I said in the beginning, the differentialists I gave you were my top differentialists for specific combinations of findings. Now that you've kind of gone through this with me, you can adopt this kind of a general approach if you feel it works good for you. And there are two really excellent books which are helpful. So once you've gone through this kind of process, you can then assess, okay, fine, I've got these and these findings. And you will not need to memorize all differentials because in these books, you've got it all summarized for you. So once you've gone through this kind of recipe, you can go to a list of differentials and kind of find and just remind you of what is out there, what other conditions you need to consider. And importantly, what you'd then want to do is to also look at are there any additional radiographic findings which might help me to narrow down the list of differentials? Because, of course, we want to be as specific as we possibly can. So, examples of additional findings would include enlarged lymph nodes, presence of megaesophagus. So, enlarged lymph nodes would help you to identify, for example, neoplasia or granulomatous infectious disease. You could have megaesophagus that would make a change in the cranial ventral lung field more likely to be aspiration pneumonia. If you've got cardiomegaly, that would increase the likelihood of cardiogenic edema and a hypervascular lung pattern. Presence of pleural effusion or pneumothorax, perhaps with trauma, pleural effusion also with neoplastic disease, just as rough examples. Then again, rib vertebral lesions or fractures, again with trauma. And if you've got masses or bone lesions elsewhere in the body, that could alert you that probably the changes are indeed more likely to be pulmonary metastases rather than eosinophilic granulomatosis, for example. So those are just really some examples. And then finally, once you've done all this, you go to your history, correlate everything with the clinical signs and your lab tests, and then hopefully you can arrive at a very kind of short list of differentials. However, as I said at the beginning, sometimes all you can do is to narrow it down really to a few differentials because there's so much of an overlap. And in our clinic as well, it's very rare that we tell our clinicians just one or two differentials. Quite often we'll say, well, I can tell you neoplasia is my top differential, but I cannot rule out non-neoplastic disease. So this was my approach to lung. To the lung in a nutshell. I know that we are kind of edging on with time, but I would be very, very happy to take any questions. So I've got time, I've got no time limitations. If you've got any questions, then please feel free to ask. I don't think that there've been any so far, but if you do have any, then please just let me know. And if you, I do not mind to be contacted at work. If there's anything which comes to mind later in the clinic, or you suddenly remember a question, then please feel free to contact me at work. The work email is petra@andersonmoores.com. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that, Petra. On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Petra for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.